So, good evening, and thank you, Jim, for the introduction and the invitation to speak this evening. And I'm going to talk about the precepts. And so it's nice that some of you are studying the evolution of the precepts. And this talk is coming from how the precepts are evolving for me right now. And part of the context for that is that, and this talk is in part of a teaching team for a course called The Dharma of Being Anti-Racist. So engaging anti-racism as a white person and engaging the Dharma in relation to that, this is like a key context for me right now and how the precepts are alive. And one kind of general frame I wanted to offer here is that the precepts, and, you know, sometimes also, you know, like we call it shila or morality or ethics, these are sometimes given a kind of foundational role in the practice. And in that kind of picture, you know, my moral or my ethical life can appear to be something I take care of that so I can get to the real work of meditation and wisdom. And so in contrast with that picture, I would also say we can look at the work of meditation and wisdom as foundational to genuine, engaged, moral, ethical life, a life of the precepts, a life of relational activity, which is also where awakening is most fully expressed and actualized. And so I bring this up because I want to kind of, I think there can be a problem of privileging meditation and wisdom in relation to action and activity in the world, worldly relationships. So my practice of the precepts, my ethical and moral life, this is a kind of matter of what I do and what I don't do, my action and inaction. And it's also how do I do what I do? Where am I acting from? And what is sustaining me in deeply and thoroughly engaging the precepts? And then shifting this to the Dharma of being anti-racist. Likewise, being anti-racist is a matter of what I do and what I don't do, and also includes these same lines of inquiry. Now, how do I do what I do? Where am I acting from? And what is sustaining me? How do I stay with it? All right, so the first chunk of this talk, I want to look at the precepts as precepts of radical relationality. And I encountered this term, radical relationality, in discourse of anti-racist, feminist, and queer organizing. And whereas I understand it, this refers to a relational approach can be cultivated in justice work. And here I want to explore a relational approach, an approach of radical relationality to living the precepts. And so to start with, radical relationality can be seen as decentering frames of doing and knowing based on white supremacy culture and colonial patriarchal mindsets. And part of why and how it's radical is that in this country, white supremacy conditioning can be so deep. And also part of why it can be radical is it's meeting systems and structures of radical dehumanization. So white supremacy culture can frame action in terms of individualism. It can frame knowing and objectivity. It can prioritize thinking over feeling, embodiment, and vulnerability, and can emphasize intent over impact. And so radical relationality points to another approach in all those dimensions, where my ethical and moral participation is fundamentally relational. You know, so then to talk about speech is then totally intertwined with listening. And skillful action is intertwined with being receptive and fully in touch, you know, with my vulnerability. And so this is a shift, you know, from speech and action as functions of a self experienced as separate, you know, to conversation, interaction as functions of relational selves. You know, so when I hear speech and action, I hear kind of like a one-way scenario, you know, from me out. And, you know, a one-way communication or action, you know, is an individualistic mode. Relationality is, and also in, back and forth, giving and receiving, you know, all at once. And it's usually a lot more work. And it can be complex. And it's a heart work. And I kind of, you know, in this talk, working with these teachings, I feel my heart, you know, stretching the whole time, or squeezing, or it's like a tenderizing. You know, and relationality is showing up fully and opening in and opening out, you know, turning on each other. Also, this another way of looking at this radical relationality is not just that I, as a self, have relations, but that I'm nothing apart from relations to the core of my being. So this is no self. This is the teaching of emptiness. Emptiness, you know, in a positive expression, emptiness is that things happen through relationality completely. There's nothing apart, nothing out of relationship. We couldn't know or think or feel anything if it's separate or if we're separate. So one facet of engaging the precepts in terms of this radical relationality is that I want to offer is locating myself. So in the context of race, this is locating myself as white, locating myself in the fabric of racial conditioning. And I could add that, you know, I'm white and I mostly grew up in the city of Chicago. And my racial conditioning could be labeled also white liberal. And white liberal is a pattern, you know, that can involve, I would say, like some heavy layers of denial and also a kind of othering of explicit racism, you know, as bad. And, you know, I don't do that. And but also this denial of, you know, systemic and structural racism, you know, that can flourish in white liberalism. And when I, you know, when I deny systemic racism, I deny inequity, suffering, harm, violence, you know, like a deep, broad, pervasive dehumanization. And so locating myself is this kind of this vital aspect of engaging precepts of relationality. Locating myself as part of acknowledging my place in relationship. And, you know, my conditioning in white supremacy culture is to hold myself as an individual. Locating myself as white is to start to acknowledge rather than deny how racial conditioning functions through me. And it can also disrupt this kind of claim of objectivity, that there's some objective viewpoint. You know, I'm in what's happening, and I'm shaped and limited by my location. And as I open to that, I open more fully to actual relationship. And that is, this is where skillful action can arise. If I come into a situation or a meeting or a moment of suffering, you know, from above, you know, from outside, you know, without locating myself, I feel I'll be unskillful. I will maintain and potentially deepen structures of harm. You know, anything that makes me feel separate, you know, is an ethical liability. And, you know, there's this teaching of Indra's net, you know, which is this vast net of jewels, in which each jewel reflects all the other jewels in the net, and in which each reflection of each jewel also reflects all the jewels in the net and all the reflections of all the jewels in the net, and so on. And so this is an image of relationality. It's an image of awakened realization. It's a vision of liberation. And I would offer it, I don't realize this net from outside the net, but from where I'm located in the net. And so, you know, when I locate myself as white, you know, then and how is that location? You know, and I can inquire, like, how does being white take up space? How does being white sit in relationship? In the U.S., in many, many contexts, whiteness is often centered in ways that are kind of often transparent or kind of unconscious to white people and potentially harmful to people of color. You know, and this is an uncomfortable truth. You know, right here, I'm giving this talk. I'm a white person, you know, being centered yet again here on this teaching square. But acknowledging that is not the problem. Acknowledging that's not a defeat or a failing. It's allowing something to come into true, to come into view. And acknowledging, you know, uncomfortable truths is a starting place for engaging a process of transformation and liberation. You know, and this is finding my place where I am, you know, in the Genjo Koan. My agency, my potentials for skillful action are not in escaping from my location. They're inseparable from my particular location. The more fully I can arrive here, you know, rather than finding myself stuck here, I'm coming to a clear and fuller sense of how I'm actually showing up in relationship. And this is where my agency can unfold and my intimacy with my suffering, with my fear, with my hurt, with my wounds, with my closed-heartedness is right in the intimacy is where I find a spaciousness or an opening or a freedom. And with that space, some room to turn, to move. And that's, you know, a sense of agency located right here. And I'd also offer in a relational picture, my agency unfolds with my sensitivity to my impact. So I cannot control or manage or even know my impacts. But I can be sensitive to them and engaged in a kind of nonstop life of inquiry around my impacts. And so then this is like, you know, shifting from like just looking at action and to interaction, you know, speech as more in terms of conversation and precepts and in terms of like this radical relationality. You know, it's an inviting, being open to, fully receiving feedback. Entering a mode of inquiry where I don't really ever get to know fully if what I'm doing is good or bad, or right or wrong, or helpful. And I would offer the precepts are not really about judging or evaluating my actions like that, or about checking boxes. They're about how do I open to skillful relating or liberating action. And this is an open-ended process, you know, imbued with inquiry and intimacy and growing. And, you know, like easy answers or preset answers don't serve me in a process of liberation. Thinking I know how to live the precepts does not serve the life of the precepts. So I keep coming back to questioning myself and my life. And this can be a gentle curiosity. And this can also sometimes be a little more pressing interrogation. And these precepts are precepts of endless inquiry, because showing up with answers is not relational. You know, at a certain point around 1,000 years ago, the Zen tradition did a kind of radical thing. They stopped being really into answers. They started having koans. You know, and a koan is not something, it's not really an answer. There's not something for me to figure out or, you know, solve in that kind of way. I live with the koan through my life and into liberation. And the precepts can be koans. And I'd also offer the Dharma being anti-racist, you know, on. And my deepest offering is not something I bring with me, but what arises in the meeting. What arises in relationship is not what I expect. Because what I expect is always a small picture, small circle of water of what is possible. Life, meeting life, is too dynamic, you know, to fit into something I can think of beforehand. So now I want to bring up the first 5 grave precepts in this context of anti-racism and radical relationality. And, you know, these are precepts of fundamental moral and ethical living, and they're precepts of awakened or liberating action. And in their traditional form, the precepts don't really tell us what to do. They point out or illuminate spheres of suffering and harm to self and others. And then these are also potentially spheres of responsibility. And receiving the concrete guidance of the precept, it's up to me to explore and acquire into how I will engage, you know, what will I do? So not killing is the first great precept. And killing is usually upheld as the most grave form of harm. You know, the legacy of killing, shaped by racism in the United States, is profound and immense. You know, from the genocides of peoples native to this land, to the slave trade, the institution of slavery, lynchings, police killings, many other forms. Mariam Kaba refers to present-day policing, imprisonment, sentencing, and surveillance as death-making institutions. I also feel harming and not caring for life is evident, you know, inequities in the healthcare system. So these are right now major systemic issues to address right now. You know, and as a white person, inquiring, how do I benefit from these systems? How do I contribute to their perpetuation? How do I participate in changing and reforming these systems of harm? And not killing extends to harming and dehumanizing and cutting off the vitality and wholeness of myself with all my identities, and others with all their identities. The second grade precept is not stealing. Likewise, you know, profound and immense legacy of racism in this country, stealing these lands, repeatedly violating treaties, stealing lives, stealing labor, taking what is not given, taking whatever I want, holding all or most of the power. And, you know, entitlement, feeling entitled to be centered, to be cared for, to take up a lot of space and attention, and taking credit. And also a cultural appropriation, which, you know, I reflect on this in my seat, in my position in life right here, you know, as a priest in a tradition of Buddhism rooted in Japanese culture. And so I reflect on, I question myself, how is my conditioning in white supremacy culture shaping how I hold and embody this traditional practice, how I pass it on? How is Soto Zen something I can grasp and hold as my possession? And how do I receive this tradition as something to care for, something to give myself to? And how do I ongoingly, you know, honor and acknowledge the roots of my practice in another culture and care for that, you know? And rather than taking and holding and possessing, how is it to share? How is it to become part of a greater circle, or, you know, to enter into a partnership? And how is it to relate, you know, without trying to get something out of it? So the third grade precept is not engaging in sexual misconduct. And here I see this precept reflected in objectification as a mode of dehumanization and activity, which flows from objectification. You know, where my gaze reduces myself or another in the integral fullness of subjectivity, you know, to an object. You know, like exotification is another way this appears. How have my experiences, my dreams, my imagination as a white person been shaped by the standards of beauty, value, and status upheld in white supremacy culture? You know, reducing a person to one identifiable aspect of their identity or how they appear. And personhood becomes mediated by race, and then actual relationship and actual human to human meeting is obstructed. And, you know, our differences can be honored without the reductionism of objectification. So meeting through differences is actually the gift of a relationship, of a genuine encounter. And the fourth grade precept is not speaking falsely. And what came up for me here is the big lie of denial. Ibram X. Kendi says, the heartbeat of racism is denial. You know, not acknowledging histories and legacies of racism, harm, violence, purposeful inequity. You know, teaching a kind of fairy tale as history and fabricating a myth of equal opportunity and believing it's a reality. So denial is a key defense mechanism of white supremacy culture. And as an individual, white person, not acknowledging how I've been shaped by white supremacy culture and how I've been shaped, you know, at some level, even with my liberal upbringing, you know, to feel or believe that the inequities pervading the society are because some people are less than others. And there's the lie of race as being something more than a social construct. And the idea of racial purity, the idea that race reflects something biological. And there's lies of justification and lies of, you know, gaslighting. So, you know, racism is riddled with deception because it doesn't make sense. You know, and for a white person, or as a white person, with self-deception. And the fifth grade precept, not using intoxicants. And here, what comes up for me is addiction to wealth, power, addiction to comfort. You know, being intoxicated by some fantasy of superiority. Or, you know, as a white person, believing my success is wholly due to my inherent intelligence, diligence, and values, and not seeing a system or a structure that's favoring me. And the right to comfort has been identified as a feature of white supremacy culture, which can derail any kind of reasonable and meaningful acknowledgement or discussion of race. So on some level, valuing comfort over truth, justice, and genuine relationships. And when I think of intoxication, I also think of escape and lifting off, disembodiment, disassociation, checking out, leaving my location. Many forms of evading responsibility, many forms of not dealing with the harm illuminated by all the precepts, of evading profound racialized suffering past and present, you know, that has shaped me and that by being unconscious, I can perpetuate. And, you know, forms of evading being human. So those are some of my offerings for tonight on the five precepts, the first five precepts. And, you know, I'm interested in hearing, you know, what, you know, maybe in the Q&A, if you have other ways, you know, we can expand these precepts in relation to systemic suffering. And now I want to try and speak to some of the challenges I encounter in engaging these precepts of radical relationality in my location as a white person. And in this course we're teaching, we're doing, part of how we're exploring this is through a memory. And so one of the memories I've been working with is when I was around 8 or 9 or 10 years old, I was on a family trip. And I met some slightly older boys who were white. And on the last day of the trip, they asked me where I was from. And I say, Chicago. And they immediately started calling it the N-word city. And I'd never heard this before. And they got excited and giddy. And I got quiet. And I did not know what to say. I did not know how to respond. And I was afraid. And I said bye and left them and just like avoided them until we left. And at the time, you know, looking back and thinking what was happening for me, I felt alone and isolated and scared. I did not feel safe. I did not know how to respond. And I had some shame around not responding. And I did not feel like I could talk to anyone about this. And I didn't until this year for this particular memory. And for all my racial memories or, you know, memories involving something about race, I didn't talk about them at all, I think, at the time, not for decades. And so I bring this up as an example of how my racial conditioning was like already well developed at a fairly young age, and a glimpse of some of the challenges of engaging these precepts. So I want to look at kind of like, well, how come I did not speak up, or, you know, or have any action in response to this aside from running away? And I want to bring this up because I feel there's a lot of overlap between that moment and this moment, and why, how it happens that now I can still fail to speak up or act. And so first I want to talk about fear. And that the presence of fear is not a lack of courage. A lack of courage is when I don't do something I actually want to do because I'm allowing fear to dictate my life. So how do I work with fear? Or, you know, how do I become intimate with fear? How do I befriend my fear? And this is an embodied intimacy. You know, and so fear is uncomfortable. You know, fear hurts. And so gently, I feel into that hurt. And I become, you know, as close to it as I can. And I cannot, and part of that is encountering old habitual ways. I've tried to manage the pain of the fear, either pushing it down, numbing it out, any way to not feel it. And so I allow all that to open just by the intention to feel. So putting a lot of trust in presence. And then I also find my fear can unfold often into another kind of pain. My experience of fear is usually fairly vibratory. There's like a lot of movement. This other pain isn't moving like that. Sometimes it's kind of sloshing or churning, but it's slower. And sometimes it's just really just static. But it's, and I would say it's a wound. And it's, I would say it's the wound from a wound from the past that I'm projecting into the future. It's what I'm actually afraid of. You know, so, you know, when I'm really afraid of something, I have an idea about something that's going to happen. What's scary about it? And this wound is what's scary about it. So how do I befriend this wound or wounds? And how do I offer full presence? You know, my wound, I find it could be a wound of feeling I don't matter, or a wound of feeling I'm not enough, or a wound of rejection, or a wound of not belonging. And again, what I find helpful and healing is just the intention to feel, just the presence, awareness, intimacy. And I thought it might be surprising that, you know, as a white person, part of my wounding in white supremacy culture is a wound of not mattering. And I think it's interesting, but I think white supremacy culture does not teach me how I matter in a true sense. How I matter in a true sense thrives in equality. You know, and this mattering in terms of mattering more or less than, this is a deprived way of mattering. So from my location, how do I get in touch with the fullness of my wound and my suffering? How do I feel the depth of the earth on this spot of ground? Now, living in reaction to my fear can lead me to feel like I can only act or speak up when I'm certain, you know, when I know I'm right, when I have all the answers. And that's a non-relational approach. And when I'm intimate with my and my wound, right there is where I can find courage. And this is a courage to respond and act, you know, without having answers, without knowing, right, maybe without even knowing why I'm showing up. And another challenge I want to bring up here is finding a good way to work with shame. And I feel like, you know, feeling bad about something I've done can be part of a transformative process, you know, working towards a new sense of responsibility, ownership, and agency. Shame can be a healthy part of seeing my failings and when and where and how I've made a mistake or harmed someone. You know, mistakes are unavoidable. Making a mess is unavoidable. And so the question is more like, how do I stay in relationship when I've made a mistake? And how do I stay in relationship for a process of repair? A process of repair in which, you know, the full humanity of everyone involved is acknowledged and has its place and its space. And so shame can have a function, but you know, alleviating shame or guilt, you know, won't work as a basis for my sustained and substantive, you know, ethical participation. I've been conditioned to engage self-hate as a method of self-reform, you know, but it's not an effective approach. I can't self-hate myself. I can't hate myself into intimacy. I can't hate myself into showing up fully or into entering, you know, open-hearted relationship. And so shame can become a tool of white supremacy culture, and it can be isolating. And feeling isolated, I don't reach out for guidance or support. And so this colludes, you know, with another piece of my conditioning of white supremacy culture of just not talking about race. And just pretending, you know, just pretend race isn't an issue, don't bring it up. And so I didn't. So I didn't talk to anyone about these things. And so I felt alone in it. And when I feel I can't talk about it and feel alone in it, this keeps it going, this conditioning. And so this is, you know, spiritual friendship is really important. Finding ways to be able to talk about this and process our conditioning together is really vital. You know, and my suffering is relational. And, you know, it's relational because I'm relational. And I suffer together. I suffer with, and I also heal, and I find freedom together. I find freedom with. Racism is a relational problem. And it lives through denial of relationship, of how deeply we live together in relationship. And the last challenge I want to bring up here is closed-heartedness. And I sometimes feel this is like my white out-of-touchness, and kind of lifting off, or it could be staying and thinking in the abstract, in the conceptual, or closed down, closed off, or disconnected. And so I may close my heart off if I don't want to feel pain or fear or woundedness or be in touch with my vulnerability. And when I close off my heart like this, I also close off my empathy, my basis for compassion, my ground for caring and real connection. You know, so how do I work with closed-heartedness? How do I open to my, you know, vulnerability? And here too, you know, embodied encounter with my heart center, and particularly attending to where do I feel closed? Where do I feel tense or tight or numb? And just gently breathe into these places. And again, trust a thorough, gentle presence. Yeah, and so this is part of, you know, mindfulness practice, you know, developing a way to relax and soften and open, you know, right where I would tense up, harden, or close down. Back when I was a kid and this event happened, I remember wondering, who are they talking about? And were they talking about my friends? Were they talking about people I love? And so I feel part of radical relationality is that my ethical participation is not rooted in an abstract principle or some definition of what is right and good. It's rooted in love and real human connection. And I feel this is like the actual source of my ethics and my being anti-racist. And so what will sustain my engagement? You know, being right or looking good or obligation or shame, you know, or none of these. How do I stick with it? You know, what will actually sustain me? Thich Nhat Hanh says that the precepts are love in action. And my sense is that love is self-sustaining. You know, the more I can act from love, the more fully I can open and actualize love in relationship, the more fully I am drawn to once again act from love. It's like warm hand to warm hand. Open-heartedness, you know, building trust. Actualizing a broader and deeper communities of humanness. So maybe that's enough of me talking. And so thank you very much. So I think we have some time for anything you'd like to express. Any questions?
I have a question, but I don't know how to go into the reaction box.
I think you can ask a question right now.
Oh, okay. Thank you so much, Corin. I don't know if you've opened up a can of worms. Maybe the can was already open. You know, I feel and I believe that at the heart of my shame, at the heart of my behavior, at the heart of my feelings, is that I did not belong, that I was not included. And a lot of it was passed down through my father, who was an alcoholic, and my mother, who would get away from us. She couldn't stay with us for a full year. She had to leave and get away from us. And then I tried everything possible to get away from the family.
Oh, I lost your sound there.
And what you just shared, that you identified yourself as white. And I see that as a first step into, whether it's covert or overt, whether it's conscious or unconscious, I see that as the first step into being not so much a participant, but even as a non-participant to racism. To say that I'm white or that I'm black or that I'm this or I'm that is to accept the premise of who I am. That's what I'm identifying with. And so the first step out of it is to become anti-self. To be anti-racist, I have to be anti-self. If I identify myself as white or black, then I have to deny myself in order to turn away from it. And if I don't do anything, then I might as well be anti-human. And so I don't mind being shameful now. I was shameless. And I know that I used fear as a defense. And I know that I feared a loss of identity. And so my question to you is, how does the precepts build me up and restore me to my humanity. You know, a long time ago, when called upon to make a decision, I couldn't just pick one precept because all of them were so invaluable and so relative to how my life had unfolded. But I noticed that the way that you shared the precepts in connection to being anti-racist, it brought up something in me that I had not really been able to identify, and that it doesn't have to be just one precept. It brings me to a place where I can practice what Shakyamuni Buddha practiced, which is that there is no separation in the practice from my action.
Right, thank you. Yeah, so how do the precepts support you to fully belong as the human you are?
Yes.
Yeah. No, I feel like I feel like that's, you know, fully being ourselves is like this, you know, in its fullness, that's their source of the precepts. All the precepts are coming from that, and that's what all the precepts are pointing to. And I feel like we do totally belong just as we are in the universe. The whole universe and all the specific things that happened to us made us this person. And this is a form of belonging that nothing can change or impact on. And I feel that I can, when I can locate myself as white, as part of how I arrived here, not all of how I arrived here and not all that I am, but a part of it. I experience it as a helpful thing for me to do. But I would not say that it's, you know, what everyone should do. I think we each have to inquire into, you know, what is our true expression.
I think Biba has her hand raised.
Can you guys hear me?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you so much, Corin. I love how humble you are to ask for guidance, because I think that's what life is about, you know. I feel like when we let go of everything and we're sitting with stillness, it's like we know that love and peace is here right now. Like that's the truth. It's just that the fear that you were talking about, sometimes it stops us from taking action. And that feeling of like, why does my actions matter? Or just that feeling of like, my actions aren't important because this giant is so big. What does it matter what I do? And I think that's like the premise of why fear is so strong, because people feel like what they do doesn't matter. I don't know if you've ever heard the saying that everybody's a book. So every action, every inaction is a part of your book. Mm. So it's like having enough trust and strength within yourself when you know that something feels wrong or it's out of balance, to just, you know, I guess in the situation, having the courage to be the bad guy. Because being the bad guy can be good. Especially in a situation like that, where it's like, we know who the real bad guy is. But in the heat of the moment, you're the bad guy. And that's like yin and yang. Yin and yang, there's a tiny dot of the different color in each one. Because I think we just want to be good so much. I think that's what it is. We want to be good so bad. But we have to get to a point where we realize, I'm going to be good and bad. And I don't care. Because that's yin and yang. That's universal law. I'm backed by the universe. And that's empowering when you know that. You know, you just have to let go of the idea of wanting to be good. I am new to this temple, by the way, but I've been studying Taoism for 10 years. It says people who try to be good end up doing bad. I forget which one it was that mentioned that, but it's like, stop seeking to be anything. Because when you stop seeking to be anything, the truth will come. And there's a time for our meditations, like how we do, but there's also a time for action, and that's yin and yang. That's day and night. Yeah. That's man and woman. This is what nature shows us. So it's like, study nature and just don't be anything. Don't be anything. And your actions are so powerful. And inactions are so powerful. So powerful. You know, even your talk today, so powerful. It got me talking. So don't be afraid to be the bad guy. Because maybe in hindsight, when people look back on things, they're like, yeah, I was wrong. Because it's timeless. Past, present, future, it's timeless. Just do what you know is in congruence with universal truth, and you'll be okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. And I resonate with what you're saying in terms of the good and bad. It's sort of like my white liberal conditioning is sort of like, well, I'm not racist, and if anything racist appears in my thinking or in my feeling, just like reject that and get rid of it as quickly as possible. But that's not transformative, and it still actually lives through me. Just it's all unconscious. So how do I let it become conscious so it can actually open and transform? Thank you.
Jim?
Yeah, thank you, Charlie. What I'm taking away from your talk is this idea of radical relationality, and you're bringing up Indra's net, and I still feel after many years of practice that there's still resistance to like some jewels in the net, you know, that like I was thinking, I go by this homeless camp every week, and my first reaction is basically, I wish that wasn't there, but it's not like I wish. I think it's, you know, if I ask myself, it's like, well, I wish those people had a home, but But also there's this other part that it's, oh, I just don't want that in my view, you know? I don't want that, you know, I don't want to see that. And so, you know, that, well, I guess that's my confession, you know, that this is the work of, this is the work of a long, long time to see every being, every condition as equal in the net. So thank you for that.
Yeah, and if there's something we don't want to see, it's always good to, it's a good place for inquiry. You know, what's happening there? What am I averse to? Anything I'm averse to, what's going on there? What how come I'm averse to it? What is it touching in me?
Right.
Thank you.
Richard.
Hello. Thank you, Corin, for that talk. I liked how you added to the precepts that it was relating, and how you also, I guess, matched that with not just the current climate, but also adding the intricacies to it. One of the things you said, which you know, I really liked, was the sexual misconduct, objectification. You know, that really touched me, because you know, the culture, and also, you know, growing up as a kid, and you know, I guess this is American culture. This is, you know, and my African American culture is the hip hop culture. You know, objectification is big, and it's almost, you know, ubiquitous in our culture. And I remember being younger and somebody bringing it up to me, and I was, you know, at first I was like, I didn't know what to do about it, because I didn't know it existed, you know, or I didn't know it was in the culture and I was participating in it. So when someone brought that up to me, it was, you know, it's like you said, you know, first I didn't understand it. Then I had shame. And I think Biba talked about it as being the bad guy. And, you know, I guess I understood what Biba was saying, you know, because it's not like you're the bad guy, but then with the shame, you almost don't want to be the person who was doing wrong. But then it was, you know, past that shame, it was, oh, if I really acknowledged that I had a wrong perception and that I was unwittingly doing something that was dehumanizing somebody, whether it was just like you said, by your action, by your gaze. And when you realize that, I guess, get past the shame part and being okay, not being the bad guy, but being wrong, you know? So, you know, I really liked your spin on that. And, you know, I think I see where Biba's coming from, where I feel like our culture is maybe a lot of people who don't want to feel shame, don't want to feel that they've done something wrong. Or in that case, they don't want to be the bad guy, right? Yeah. But, you know, in my case, you know, I've said the same thing to people. You know, I've been the person who has wronged and who, you know, who has wronged others. And it is through acknowledging that, you know, I feel that, you know, I can work on stuff. You know, when I don't acknowledge that I have done something wrong, then it's almost like, how can I work on it? So thank you for putting that spin on the precepts.
Thank you. Yeah. Yeah, I would say it's what's coming up for me right now is it's And it's not good to always feel like we're good. That's not good. it's not even helpful. Yeah. And it's not, and nor is it good to always think we're bad, right? But to kind of how do we have an honest assessment of what we're doing? How do we see it clearly? You know, bring it into awareness, acknowledgement, and then a place where, you know, some spaciousness can open, where some new agency can find itself. Thank you.
So Todd would like to speak. He doesn't have the hand raise, you know, icon, but he's here. He wants to speak.
Hey. Yeah. Hey, Charlie.
Hey, Todd.
Good to see you again.
Yeah.
It's been a long time.
Yeah.
Thank you for your talk tonight. I thought it was amazing, actually wonderful. And just personally, I've been struggling with, you know, these issues for a few years now after kind of coming. Well, I married a woman of color, and she's kind of been bringing, you remember Christine, maybe.
Yeah, of course.
And so, so she's been bringing this up in me, right, pretty clearly. And it's so painful. I just find it to be really, really deeply painful, not for me, but the sense of separation that I feel between myself and other people of color who, however, I don't know, who I see before relating to them. So at the moment that I actually relate to these people, they're, all of that sort of disappears and our humanness kind of arises in that relational space that you were talking about. And so, you know, for instance, three of my five closest neighbors are Black. And so I, you know, I don't have any sense of it. I don't feel the same sense of internal racist attitudes popping up at all in any of my relations with these people, or for that matter, somebody I meet in a coffee shop. I have this sense of that separation that comes from being, you know, essentially a racist. You know, I think all white people are racist to some degree. Any white American, anyway, we've been brought up in this culture and it's just so deeply ingrained in us. But once I speak and relate to this person, you know, all of that's like poof, just kind of disappears and it's wonderful. So, but I just wanted to make one more comment and thank you for mentioning you don't have to have all the answers in order to, or I don't have to have all the answers in order to raise an objection, for instance.
Yeah.
I find that to be freeing, you know, because I often feel like, oh, I can't really get the argument down. I don't have it down well enough, you know. It's just too much trouble to confront this person who's got these unconscious racist or maybe consciously racist attitudes. And so I just let it go. And I think that's, you know, the work will be to let go of some feeling that I have to get it right.
Yeah. I think we can let go of that and try to disrupt as much as we can disrupt. 'Cause you know, when there's this culture of letting it happen, then that's the culture where, like, you know, worse stuff can happen.
Yeah.
You know? So there's like all the, you know, there can just be jokes, right? And jokes is so easy to kind of deny that it was racist because it was just a joke. Mm. You know, but that's part of how the whole, you know, that's part of the atmosphere in which, you know, a more, you know, something worse or something more violent can happen.
Right. Yeah. Well, anyway, thank you. Appreciated your talk very much.
Thank you very much. Good to see you.
Thanks.
Okay. Linda. Oh no, Meg was next. You have to unmute yourself, Meg.
Yeah, so I just, some of what Biba said and what you said, I wanted to thank you for your talk, Charlie. Really important on so many levels. But one of the things I could go on about questions, but is it seems to me as this not good, bad. I grew up needing to be good, being told I had to do it right, had to do it best. I learned to leave mistakes and things for my father to find, so I wouldn't be devastated when he found ones that I didn't know were there. And it took me till I was in my 30s to understand that that's what I was doing. And I wonder if there isn't a part of the later precepts that this is part of, not to speak of others' faults, but also of our own faults, and not to speak at others' expense, the need to be modest. And you know, I read both of those so much about not judging. Predetermining what is good and what's bad and what's wrong and what's right. And I think it's those are such black and white descriptors that don't allow for space or relationship or intimacy. So that was my comment. Dora Lee Wells knows I struggle much with the embodiment piece. And I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about embodied encounters and the embodiment of these things that you're talking about. It was a passing two lines. And for me, that's always like, oh, wait a minute, I want to learn more. So... Thank you so much for your talk.
You're welcome. Yeah, well, one more thing about good and bad that just struck me was that I think Dogen says it's not that dharmas are good and bad. It's that good and bad are dharmas. You know, so we kind of, sometimes we hold good and bad as like these categories that we can sort things into, and they're like, I don't know, they're somehow above all actions or anyway, they're these like huge categories of existence, but they're also just stuff. They're just other things that are happening. So there's actions, there's people saying things are good, that's just another action. People saying it's bad, that's just another action, you know. And they're kind of all on the, you know, it's not like these ones are somehow above these other ideas and can kind of chop them down or something. And then embodiment, it's such a huge topic for our practice, I feel, but I feel like
sorry.
I just feel like it's really just vital to liberation and how we if we're not embodied, there is all this stuff happening in our bodies that is like going to run our lives, you know, and our own avoidance of our embodied experience and emotions, you know, if we're not in touch with that, it's going to run our lives. And because we're going to be constantly reacting to not experiencing it. And, you know, and we're going to have all our triggers and we're going to be helpless, because if you're not in touch with your body and someone, you get, your button gets pushed, you just go straight into reactivity. And so the ground of our responsiveness and freedom, you know, of a capacity to experience something and then come from our heartfelt intention is based on our kind of like, are we embodied? Are we in touch with our feelings and our sensations? And I feel like, you know, like our grasping and it's all embodied. I actually think everything we think is embodied. It's just, you know, it's just an idea that like thoughts are only happening up here. Our whole life is embodied, you know, and like body and mind are like, they're totally intertwined and inseparable. You know, it's just, it's one thing happening here, you know? And so, that's part of the gift, I feel like, of our meditation practice. It's not a conceptual exercise. It's an embodied practice. And, you know, I think you could say, like, well, you get an upright posture and you're still, and that's just like the box. And inside of the box, the real meditation is happening. And I would say I would not recommend that as the view. I would say, like, the upright body and the stillness, that is the real practice. And meeting everything in that, you know, with awareness, with our full presence, fully engaging, this is all the practice. Yeah. So like meditation, I think if you look at it in the dictionary, I think it says something about contemplation and it sounds kind of heady, but you know, our Zazen is not a heady thing. It's a whole being thing, body, heart, emotions, thinking, you don't have to stop your thinking or get rid of your thinking, but it's just one of the things happening with all the other stuff that's happening and the sounds and the light and.
Thank you so very much. Thank you.
Linda?
Hi, Charlie. We passed Ships in the Night at Green Gulch a long time ago. It's good to see you.
I remember you.
You were so impressive coming back from Tassajara. Just like there was this Tassajara halo around you. So, there's two things I've been dealing with, and we're going kind of long here. So I'm going to let you pick. I am sometimes have trouble with the cultural appropriation of Zen in America, and I have no real clear thoughts on that. And also, toward the end, when you talked about cold-heartedness, I realized that that's where I am right now. I have been so inundated for 4 years with pain, misery, and suffering that I'm worried. I've lost my empathy that I've shut down. So either one of those things that you would like to elaborate on, I would love to hear.
I feel like we can... our hearts can close, and I feel like we can open again. And so I would really just be encouraging that, just to patiently attend to your heart, and don't try to push it, don't try to force it open, but to see if you can give yourself to feeling how it's closed or shut down. Or numb, or you know, where what's happening, and I feel like I don't know if there's something more important than that.
It's true
for our human life.
Yeah,
and I would say for cultural appropriation, I feel like it's a great question. I feel like we should be living with this question. I feel like I'm going to live with this question for the rest of my life, and I feel like I'd be a little irresponsible not to. And I don't know if I believe in a resolution to that. I just believe, like, got to keep my eyes open and watch my conditioning. And I feel like, look out, like, how could this be happening? How am I seeing this as a possession? How am I taking possession of Soto Zen? And where I'm not is where I'm giving, when I see it as I'm here to take care of Soto Zen, I'm here to take care of this practice. And when I have that kind of holding, it's kind of open-handed, you know, and I feel like, and then that doesn't feel like appropriation to me. And I feel like, but I think there's lots of questions. Robes, question, Korin, Dharma name, that's a big question. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. That's great.
Thank you. All right.
Yeah.